Hello, it's Kate Turkington, and it's the Kate Turkington Show. And I'm going to start up because I've got a story about whales to start with. Whales, you think? Well, once upon a time, I was on a ship going from Ushuaia. Ushuaia is the very, very bottom of South America. It's supposed to be the southernmost port in the world. I don't know. It's a gorgeous little town, like a ski town with mountains up behind it and log cabins. Or it was when I was there. Why was I there? Why was I on a ship? I was going to Antarctica. I was going to the Antarctic Peninsula. And off we went. And of course, you have to cross the notorious Drake Passage. I mean, the Drake Passage is like the, it's one of the worst crossings in the world. And in the old days, the sailing ships apparently, think at the bottom of South America, the Horn of Africa, the sailing ships used to tack to and from, so they actually couldn't get round the bend. They couldn't get round the Horn. Anyway, we did, because here we were, not a very big ship, going from Ushuaia to Antarctica, and the waves were crashing and the sea was rolling. And just to tell you how bad it was, just after we left port, brown paper bags arrived behind all the bars on the all the rails on the ship, brown paper bag. You can use your imagination as to what those were going to be for. Anyway, the next morning, it was still crashing and rolling, but not quite so bad. And we had guest lecturers on board who were giving us, on this case, a lecture on whales, telling us about the history, how people have always been fascinated by whales. And that morning, as the light came, we'd had two big orcas, so-called killer whales, breaching and blowing by the ship. It was so special. Anyway, on went the lecturer, and he said in very, very smug, quite supercilious tone, "Do you know," he said, "in the 50s, people paid to see a dead whale on the Thames embankment in London," and everybody tittered and laughed. And you know, the jocks who drove the Zodiac landing crafts all nudged one another. You know, weren't people quaint in that way, in that those days? And I raised my hand and I said, "I worked on that whale. I worked in that whale." Let me tell you the story. Two entrepreneurs, I suppose you call them now, two Scandinavian entrepreneurs had found a dead blue whale on the coast, I don't remember where, somewhere in Scandinavia, and they gutted it and they put a big refrigeration unit inside, and they were taking this whale to different places in Europe, and people were paying money to come and see it. It was 60 feet long. That's what, about 18 metres, I suppose. There it was on the Thames embankment. It did smell a bit, even because of the refrigeration. But, you know, you've got to remember in those days, television had just started. We didn't have David Attenborough giving us the ocean programme. We knew nothing about whales. Of course, people were so excited to come and see this whale, and it cost half a crown. And I got the job. I'd seen a notice in the Students' Union and applied, got the job. There were four students, and we took their money, which was half a crown, be about 50 South African rand now, and then we took them through to where this whale was on the huge, huge trailer. And we talked about it. And of course, we knew nothing about whales. And I think we've been employed for our histrionic abilities rather than our marine biology, of which we knew nothing, didn't even know it existed in those days. And I made up this story of Hedda. I was into Ibsen at the time. I gave the whale, I don't even know if it was she, the name Hedda. And I told this story, how she died and washed up on a beach, and her partner, Lars, I called him Lassie, Lars roamed up and down the beach uttering soulful cries. We didn't know about whale songs then either. And I was quite good at it, actually. And I used to, it was a very, very hot Easter. And we used to march the punters all the way from her tail, 60 feet all the way up to her head, and then all the way back again. They were actually exhausted at the end of their half a crown's worth. But how did I get to be in the whale? Her jaws were propped open with big steel rods, and every night the four of us would go into her jaws, we'd sit in her jaws, and we'd have a cold beer. And there we'd sit, and there was like a curtain of whalebone. You know that stuff they used to make ladies' corsets of. There was a curtain of whalebone still in her mouth. We used to sit this in her jaws, this side of the whalebone, with the refrigeration unit sort of humming at the back. So I say to people, I worked in a whale. And they say, you mean on a whale? I said, no, 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 no. I've other whale stories for another day, but that's my story. Oh, and last thing, we stood on her back and we watched the Oxford-Cambridge boat race that year, which actually Oxford, well, my boyfriend who became my husband was at Oxford, so we wanted Oxford to win. So we stood on her back and we watched the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. What happened to Hedda? She was taken to France and put on show. Then she went to Portugal, by which time I'm sure she must have been as high as a kite. But the entrepreneurs made a huge amount of money for her, from her. And it was a bold endeavour in those days. Well, I knew nothing about marine biology. I do know a little bit more. And my guest is somebody who is an expert. I've got to put my glasses on to read this because I'll never remember it otherwise. She's actually a prof, an associate prof of oceanography. Didn't even know there was a subject, oceanography. I'm really revealing my ignorance. And why am I going to be talking to her? Because she's won the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust New Frontiers Award. It's an incredibly prestigious award. About this time last year, I interviewed the last recipient of the award. And our guest today, Dr. Katie Altieri, she pipped 175 other entries to the post. Entries like astrophysicist, visual arts, neuroscience, pediatric immune disorders, ecology. Dr. Katie Altieri, welcome, welcome, welcome. And maybe let's start with the award. Where were you? What did you feel? What happened when you heard you'd won?
Thanks, Kate. Thanks so much for having me. It was very exciting. It was a long process. I had to submit first a short proposal and then a long proposal, and then I flew to Johannesburg for an interview panel with a very prestigious panel. And then about 3 or 4 days later, I was in the midst of a meeting that wasn't going very well, and I got an email that said, congratulations. And I thought, oh, this is going to make my day. It was very exciting.
And you're so young and you're so beautiful. I can say that because I'm a very old person, but you don't look like somebody who has their heads buried in research. But first of all, those of us who aren't scientists, can you give us a kind of quick, big picture of what your research is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. I always tell people when I'm talking about my work to think you're at the beach. And when you're at the beach, you think to yourself, oh, it's so clean. This air I'm breathing, it's so refreshing. But what people don't realize is that air pollution travels through the atmosphere and it actually makes its way to the ocean. Air pollution isn't just about something that happens near where we have cars or power stations. And my research is about understanding how much air pollution gets out to the ocean and what happens. How does it impact the ocean? And does it ultimately connect with climate change? And that's really the big uncertainty that I'm getting at with the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust New Frontiers Research Award, are these unknown connections between air pollution, the ocean, and climate.
Because, you know, you even mention climate change now and people's eyes glaze over. You know, there's almost a climate change fatigue, if you know what I mean. We all know it's happening, but your research is totally new. So this pollution rolls out to the ocean. You know, you don't think of that. You think it sort of dissipates. It rolls out over the ocean. What happens?
So the particular part of air pollution I study is nitrogen. And if anyone is a gardener or has ever tried to grow a plant, you use nitrogen as a fertilizer. And there are tiny plants in the ocean, they're called phytoplankton, but they take the nitrogen and air pollution and they grow as if they had been fertilized. And when they're growing, what they do is they use carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I mean, just like trees on land do, right? They take carbon dioxide and they make plant. And that actually helps because we have this human-derived carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And the ocean is a big sort of sink. We call it a sink. It takes some of that bad carbon dioxide and pulls it into the ocean and puts it away, so that it minimizes climate change. And what we're finding is that this nitrogen and air pollution can help enhance that process. So it's helping the ocean pull more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which slows climate. But there's a big but, is that nitrogen can then go on through other processes in the ocean and lead to the emissions of nitrous oxide. Now, nitrous oxide is a greenhouse gas we hear about less often. But it's 300 times more powerful than CO2 at warming the atmosphere. And so it's possible that some of this nitrogen and air pollution, while it's helping take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, it might be leading to nitrous oxide going into the atmosphere. And we don't understand that balance very well. And that's the sort of novelty of the research that I'm proposing, is we need to understand which of these processes is happening.
So, Dr. Katie, what will be the best outcome for the world, for climate change, for all of us? What would you hope to see or like to see, or is it possible?
Well, for me, it's more about we need to understand. Before you can fix a problem or even declare it a problem, you have to understand what's happening. And that's really the state we're at with the research I'm doing now, is I can't even tell you if it's good for climate, if the net effect is that we get more CO2 out, or if it's actually bad for climate, and the net effect is we get nitrous oxide emissions into the atmosphere. We don't know. I don't know the answer to that question yet. And so it's very hard to say, oh, well, here's how we can fix the problem, because, well, what's the problem? Is it a problem? Is it big? Is it small? I mean, these are really fundamental things, and we don't know the answer yet, but the goal of this research over the next 5 years is that we will know the answer, and then we can start to say, here's the scale of the problem, and then do we go to solution space.
And I mean, physically, you know, my mind's racing. How do you actually measure this? How do you do it? Do you spend your days in a lab looking at test tubes or doing whatever scientists do in labs? Or are you out at sea? Tell me, how is the research conducted?
Both of those, plus more. So we collect air pollution on land before it gets out to the ocean. And we do this partly in Cape Point in the Nature Reserve. There's a lovely atmospheric research station there. But then we also go to sea. South Africa has an amazing research vessel, the RV SA Agulhas II. It's a world-class polar research vessel for South African research. We take it out into the open ocean, and we measure the air pollution there. We measure rain, if we're lucky enough to capture a rain event. And we take samples from the surface ocean, and we do experiments with them. So we'll take water from the surface ocean, and we'll add things to it and measure how things change. And we take all of that back to the laboratory at the University of Cape Town, and we do a whole suite of measurements and analyses looking at test tubes, as you alluded to. And then ultimately, when we want to scale up and really understand the problem, we have to use a numerical model. So we take the results of our work on land, our work on sea, our experiments, what we get out of the lab, and I have collaborators who then run numerical models and get us this big picture. You know, they come back and say, this is how much carbon dioxide could be pulled out of the atmosphere. This is how much nitrous oxide could be going into the atmosphere. So it's really, it's kind of every aspect of science.
And you, I think you work with a research vessel, don't you?
Yes, that's right. So the South African research vessel, the SA Agolis 2, is our primary tool that we use. And we can go to sea. That takes us to the Southern Ocean, takes us often to the Benguela off our west coast of South Africa, out into the South Atlantic. We go off the east coast into the Indian Ocean, where we have the Agulhas Current. So we're very fortunate here in South Africa to have access to such a research vessel where really we can do any state-of-the-art science you can think of, we can do it on our South African research vessel.
Yeah, that, I'm thinking that's like perfect. You've got the Benguela Current, you've got Indian Ocean, Atlantic, you've got, you're in the perfect place in the Cape to do this. Do you ever get seasick?
I personally get very seasick. I don't love going to sea. The nice thing about getting old is now it's going to sea isn't really so much my job. It's for my students and the early career researchers. They're the ones who benefit the most from the opportunity to be on ship and to be out doing the field work. I did it when I was an early career scientist, but I'm now at the stage of my career where I put together the team, I help them get trained up, and I send them all off onto the vessel. And I stay back on land where I belong.
And how did you ever, you know, you talked a bit earlier about, you know, think you're on a beach and you smell clean air and, you know, the breezes and everything. But how did you actually pinpoint this particular area of research? I mean, did you have an electric light bulb pop out of your head with the idea, or was it the result of a lot of work and research?
It was the result in some ways of a happy coincidence. I am a chemist by training, and then I went on to do my PhD in oceanography. And very early on as a postgraduate student, I went to a workshop with a bunch of the world's experts on nitrogen cycling. And I was one of only three students there, and I got to hear them talk about these uncertainties about, gosh, there's so much nitrogen. We've doubled the nitrogen cycle on Earth. We've doubled the amount of nitrogen that flows through. I mean, this is huge. And they were talking about these different things. Where does it go? And then there was this question of, do we have to worry about the ocean? And it was like, the ocean's so big. We don't have to worry about the ocean. But it stuck with me, and I've been working on this kind of ever since I was a PhD student, and small fits and starts, little aspects of this process of nitrogen cycling and pollution and what happens in the ocean. And this New Frontiers Research Award is really an opportunity for me finally, all these years later, to bring it together and really tackle this in a big picture sense. And I'm really excited about it.
Because we talk about the Earth as the lungs of humanity and whatever. But I think I've read, I haven't watched this latest David Attenborough thing, Ocean, but he's just come out and said oceans are the most important thing for the future of humankind. So oceans perhaps more important than land. What's your view?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a water planet. You know, 70% of the Earth is covered by the ocean. And that means 70% of our atmosphere is a marine atmosphere. Now, as scientists who study the atmosphere, we've historically focused on the atmosphere over the land because that's where people are. And that's very important. Air quality, air pollution is a very important topic. But we've neglected the fact that our atmosphere is actually a marine atmosphere. And the bulk of what happens on Earth is happening either in the ocean or in an atmosphere that is over the ocean. And that's a space where we haven't nearly explored as much as we should. We don't understand as much as we should. And if we want to understand how climate is changing, that's where we really, you know, need to know what's going on, not this small bit of our continent, especially in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, yeah, where it's even more ocean dominated.
And I was thinking, you know, people listening or watching, right now might be thinking, why does this matter to me? How important is this to me? What would your answer be?
Well, this work connects on air quality, which is a shared commons, right? No matter where you live in South Africa or in the world, you are impacted by the quality of the air you breathe. And this is something we know causes early mortality, impacts childhood asthma, impacts on a number of diseases that, you know, sort of are inherent to all of us. No one is immune. It doesn't matter how much money you have or where you live, this impacts you. And similar in some ways to climate. You know, in South Africa, we're not responsible for the bulk of historical carbon emissions, but droughts, heat waves, extreme rainfall, flooding, we're certainly experiencing all of these. And so it's very hard for someone, you know, really to not be touched by these issues of air pollution and climate, or have someone very close to you be touched by them.
And I was wondering, were there actually any wow moments in your research? Was there a kind of, oh my word, I've cracked it, or, you know, the light bulb again? Or has it just been really hard plodding, swimming, really hard work, or both?
It's both. When I was did my first field campaign, it was actually in the island of Bermuda, which is off the coast of the U.S. in the North Atlantic.
Yeah.
And there we were looking, we thought, oh, this will be a great place to study nitrogen pollution hitting the ocean. Because you're near North America, you know, there's a lot of pollution coming off. And our biggest finding out of that work was very unexpected, which is that the ocean itself has a really important nitrogen flux between the atmosphere that has nothing to do with humans. And we really did not anticipate that. We thought we were just going to be seeing this big pollution signal, and then sometimes you go out in the real world and the real world says, no, actually, it doesn't work that way. There's a much bigger cycle happening and has nothing to do with humans. And that was kind of a like, whoa, okay, we didn't think about that, you know, need to factor that in, and it was unexpected. And so it does happen sometimes where, you know, you think you know what you're going to see and you go out and, you know, you just don't. But it's a lot of plotting. I've also been surprised by penguins in Antarctica, some work we've done in the Southern Ocean, where we thought, all right, we're really far away from land. We're going to be studying just an ocean signal. This is going to be great. And what we discovered was that there's a heck of a lot of birds and penguins that live on the Antarctic Peninsula. And you can't just study the ocean because guano has a lot of ammonium in it, and we basically, instead of doing an ocean study, we ended up doing a bird poop study, which was not what we set out to do at all. So you do get surprised.
So it's, I've got this kind of picture in my mind of the ocean as this big mass, and it's pulling in this pollution and transforming it, or possibly, and not spewing it out, because that's got negative connotations, blowing it out much purer and better for all of us. Is that the right kind of picture I've got?
Well, in this respect, in the nitrogen, it's, you know, the ocean, what's the ocean's doing isn't good or bad per se. I wouldn't ascribe value to it. But the pollution that gets in the ocean, it then is transformed and changed. But this nitrogen pollution can end up as a greenhouse gas that comes back out. And that then acts as a greenhouse gas. And that is negative connotations for the warming of the planet. And so it isn't necessarily always positive transformations that happen, you know, and it's obviously through no fault, but that's how sometimes these cycles work. Sometimes it transforms it and makes it go away, and that's great. And then sometimes it transforms it into something that's actually even more detrimental than what it started as.
And your dream result would be good.
The dream result would be that I'm wrong, and that those nitrous oxide emissions are really small and they're not actually happening, and that the net effect is carbon dioxide removal, and so this is, you know, not necessarily detrimental for climate. But I'm agnostic. You know, as a scientist, the outcome is what it is. You know, I don't have anything I'm wishing for or hoping for, because that it will subtly bias you if you start to allow that to happen. The goal is to figure out what's happening. You know, that's where that. We have to keep our mind at.
That's why I admire science so much. You're so focused. And just a couple of things before you go. You're in the Department of Oceanography, and I really, mea culpa, I did not know, other than marine biology, that you could study such a thing as oceanography. What does it, again, in labor, maybe there's a student with us who'd love to study. You know, so many young people want to do marine biology because they think they're going to be swimming with dolphins. Meanwhile, they're going to be sitting in the lab looking at test tubes. It's not quite so romantic. But oceanography, what, in layperson's terms, what would you be studying? Other than oceans, obviously, but what kinds of things?
Yeah, oceanography is great because it's the study of the chemistry of the ocean, it's the study of the physics of the ocean, so waves and tides and how things flow. It's also the study of exchanges of heat and salt and water. So if you're interested in earth science in any way, it's almost like the perfect discipline because you can apply chemistry to it. You can apply mathematics. If you're a statistician, you can find a home in oceanography. If you love math, you can be doing the physics and applied math of oceanography. If you love the climate system, the ocean is the heart of all of climate on Earth, right? So it's a wonderful discipline in that respect. I came at it from a chemist, and I didn't want to study. All of my classmates were going on to work at pharmaceutical companies, you know, and making a better baby wipe. I wanted to be out in the real world, and I found a home in oceanography through that. And so I would say, yeah, anyone who loves earth science, anyone who loves understanding the ocean, the climate, how the world around us works, oceanography can be a place where you can find a home.
Is UCT in South Africa the only university that offers oceanography?
Nelson Mandela University is starting with an ocean science campus. And we're also really? Starting a new ocean science master's program that's going to cut across a number of universities around South Africa. So right now it's primarily focused at UCT, but that is very rapidly changing, and students from around the country will be able to. And I also want to say to any students who are listening, in undergraduate programs, we also at UCT run a program called Seamester, where you can spend 2 weeks on the SA Egolus II, learning all about oceanography, getting hands-on experience. The ship will go out for a week sailing and come back. And that accepts applications from students all over South Africa, any university with any type of science background. And it's a great way to find out if oceanography is for you.
Oh, I had no notion. Sounds absolutely gorgeous. Not last thing, Katie. And I should say I've been talking to you, and I am talking to Dr. Katie Altieri, who's also a mum. You know, it's amazing when you interview successful women. You know, if you interview a successful man, you don't think of saying he's a dad as well. But when you're interviewing successful women, cutting edge of science like you are, you can't help yourself as another woman and a mum saying, and you're a mum as well. And it's one for us. How can we follow your work now, Dr. Katie? How can we keep up with what you're doing? I mean, and I must repeat, this is such a prestigious award. I have to read it because I can't remember the whole thing, Katie. It's the Oppenheimer Memorial Trust New Frontiers Award. I think that's the key, New Frontiers, literally breaking new ground, or let's change the metaphor, making new waves in your case. If we want to follow your work, how can we do that?
So I'm a co-director of the University of Cape Town Marine Biogeochemistry Laboratory, and we have a website, uctmbl.co.za. And also through this award, we're going to be working with the media more and putting out articles and things to try to connect with the public and let people understand, you know, what it is we're doing, how we're doing it. So definitely stay tuned. There will be more to see on this.
Okay. And did you have some bubbles after you won the award? I hope you had some champagne. I hope you celebrated in true style.
We actually had milkshakes. I had practiced my speech to all the students and some colleagues in the department. And when I found out I won, we took everyone who helped me practice. I took them all out for ice cream. And we had ice cream cones and milkshakes to celebrate.
That's so special. You celebrate the 7.5 million or more with milkshakes. Love it. Dr. Yep. Katie Altieri. Thank you so much for being on, and we will follow you. I'll certainly follow you, and I'm again going to look at the oceans with yet another new eye. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now I'm going to tell you about a book I've been reading. I just need to stretch behind my laptop and find it. Here it is. Because, as you know, I review books and I don't do chick lit. I'm a terrible intellectual snob. I want to read something that's well written, got a good plot, got a good story. And by the way, I've just finished, I can't talk about it now, I haven't got it in front of me, but the last winner of the Booker Prize, it's called Orbital, and it's about being in space, being an astronaut in space, written by somebody who's not an astronaut. It's fiction. I can't for the life of me remember the title, the author, but you can remember Orbital. And you know, so often, I'm not ashamed to say this, winners of these prestigious literary prizes, they're unreadable. Some of those books, they're unreadable. But this is super. But, so Orbital, I'll tell you about that on another occasion maybe. This book is called, you can't see it, so back to front, but it's called A Duty of Care by Gerald Seymour. Now, if you love thrillers, I'm a crime fiction junkie, I must tell you, but it has to be good stuff, not, you know, the formulaic stuff, a chapter. She heard a knock at the door. She shivered. Who could it be? Next chapter. A gunshot ran out, always at the end of the chapter. You know, it's so formulaic. Somebody like Gerald Seymour is a master spy writer. Put him with John le Carré, put him with Mick Herron, put him with whoever. Except he's been going on longer. Not as long as John le Carré did, but certainly been going on. And some of you may remember, if you read thrillers or spy fiction or crime, his very first book was called Harry's Game. And he's going back a long while. Either the first or second night of South African television, I was on, of course I was on, and I did a book review. And it was on a programme called Galaxy. It was an arts programme. And the SAB said, oh no, a book review will never go down. And I had been given a copy of Harry's Game. And I thought, oh, we're going to do this. And of course, there was no auto cue in those days, no cue cards, nothing. So for 5 minutes, I learnt off by heart or talked about Gerald Seymour's book, Harry's Game. The next day, it sold out in South Africa. It became a huge international hit, and it made Gerald Seymour's name. That was about 30 books ago. He's written so many since. This is called A Duty of Care. Not quite sure how to show it to you. No, I can't show it to you on screen. It's by Gerald Seymour, and it's published by Hodder and Stoughton. And as I say, if you like good spy thrillers, and it's set in several places, but it's again, it's a spy under the radar, really being banished to a back room at M16 or M15 or the headquarters of spies in London, and inadvertently gets caught up in a kind of world plot. So we're all over the place. We're in Russia, in a gulag, where with an Albanian village. Apparently Albanians, so I believe, Albanians can be. It's alleged that Albanians are master criminals and, in fact, run all kinds of gangs around the world. It is alleged. And he uses an Albanian family, an Albanian village. He uses a gulag in Russia. He uses London. You'll love it. If you like good spy writing by a master spy thriller, as I say, A Duty of Care by Gerald Seymour, published by Hodder and Stoughton. Lots to read. Okay, that's all I've got time for at the moment. As I always say to you, and travel. I'll bring some travel in sometime. I've got lots of travel stories about, no, I won't tell you now, being abandoned in Tibet and all kinds of stuff. But for now, travel safely. Look after yourselves and, of course, look after others too.